Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening again today as we jump into lesson number 28 in our series on the book of Acts. And we will be in Acts 21, verse 18, through the end of chapter 22, which is verse 30. We'll be covering quite a bit of ground today. A lot of it's speech, so I think it'll move fairly quickly. The title of today's lesson is Paul and the Jews, Part 1. And in the next few lessons, let's see, 2, 3, 4, 5... I've got slated for 5 lessons. We will be looking at Paul Paul as he is back in Judea. His 3 missionary journeys are wrapped up, and now he is he's returned to Jerusalem. We'll see his interaction with the Jews to some extent, but also with the local rulers. He will be bound. We'll see his testimony before the chief priests and stuff. But Felix and those rulers. But the overall thing and why I've kind of going to group all of them together, it really is Paul's interaction with the Jewish people and the Jewish religion and the Jewish culture. And the rulers of the region. So it really kind of all groups together. And then after that, we'll get into Paul's journey to Rome. But quite a bit of stuff will go on here. And we're going to deal today with really kind of how the trouble gets started and what leads to him actually being arrested and kind of the cause of the problems. And a lot of it's just kind of lingering issues from the past, and some of it's just the same old thing, same old accusations. But we'll see Paul really kind of make a turning point here. It seems like Paul is always making these turning points. He never gives up on the Jews. He loves them. They're his people, but he keeps having these turning points where it's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm really supposed to be reaching the Gentiles and kind of turning away from Jewish people, whether it's, having trouble in the synagogue and saying, well, I'll go preach to the Gentiles, just throwing up his hands saying, well, I'll just preach to them. They want to hear it. To what's going to happen here, where for the first time, Paul is going to assert that he is a Roman citizen. And the implications of that. So really this is very interesting why he would do that. And part of it, I really think, is just his realization that, he's really fighting a losing battle against the Jews and that he really is the apostle to the Gentiles. So where we're going to look at, let's go ahead and set the setting up here. The events are going to take place in Jerusalem. We got Paul there in our last lesson. The year is around the year 58 AD, going by the timetable that I've been using. And, that can vary some different places. But the one I'm using, which tends to seem a little bit different than some of the other ones I've looked at. But I'm just for consistency, I'm sticking with it. And honestly, it's as good a guess as anyone. So that's got it about the year 58 AD. So without further ado, I don't guess there's anything else I really need to set up. Look at my notes. I think that does it very well. Just to realize that we'll deal with some of the rest of this, some of the setting when we get there. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves in the story. So, all right. So let's jump right in. Acts 21 and verse 18. Let's go ahead and go back to verse 17 and kind of set it up here. And when they were come to Jerusalem, and when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. So that Paul's arrived at Jerusalem, the church there has welcomed him with open arms. Verse 18, and the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. James is the half-brother of Christ. This is what most people believe this James is. We've dealt with that at some length, I think, in another episode with all the different Jameses. And is the pastor, basically, of the church there at Jerusalem. And of course, all the elders. So he's meeting with the local church leadership here, the leaders of the local church. 19. And when he had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. So he gives a report of what's going on. The souls have been saved. The lives have been changed. The report of his ministry. Verse 20. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. Verse 21. And they are informed of thee, and that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after their customs. Verse 22. What is it, therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. So kind of what they're doing here is they're trying to warn him. They're like, says, look, you're in the middle of Judea. There are Jews everywhere, and all these Jews are very zealous to keep the law. Even the Christian Jews at this point are still very much tied to, the Jewish customs and Jewish practices. And really, that break is a good 10 to 15 years from really being made in the early church. And really, it takes the Jewish revolt, that kind of from 66 to 70 AD, to really kind of facilitate that. And the church basically has to leave Jerusalem because of the war, because of the fighting. They escape into what's modern-day Jordan. And kind of set up shop over there. And really, and because of the implications of the war and how popular opinion turned against the Jews, that's really when the church really had to get away from its Jewish influences. And many of the Jewish Christians had to decide, who am I going to identify with the church or with the, with these Jews that have revolted and everyone hates. So that really kind of helps to facilitate that change. Let's see here. And basically what's happening here is they're warning him and they're saying, look, you've realized these people are so zealous of the law and they're hearing that you're going around telling people, oh, hey, it's okay not to obey the Moses' law. And, they're basically saying you're going to have issues. And issues he is going to have. We're going to get to that in just a second. But, we're going to have issues with that very point. Verse 23, Do therefore this that we say to thee, we have four men which have a vow on them. Verse 24, them take and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, and that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. So basically, what they're saying is, look, just for appearance's sake, let's go in, go through this, the ceremonial Jewish practice of purification, which basically is a separation from impure things. And there's, different, bathing and washing requirements that go along with that, and a separation, even from Gentiles and things like that, things that would be impure. And why don't you go through that with these guys, and everyone will know, hey, look, this guy's one of us. He's going through the practices. He can't be that bad. Let's see here, verse 25. As touching Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, and from blood, and from strangled, and from fornication. So the same list of four things we've covered before. But he says, they're saying basically, hey, look, that's good for the Gentiles, but listen, bud, you're still a Jew. Why don't you do this? And Paul himself, he's still a practicing Jew. He had taken a vow which kind of helps him to get in. Probably the reason why he's grouped in with these four other guys who have also had a Jewish vow. And, you know, they're just going through the ceremony and the practices following that. So, verse 26. Then Paul took them in, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So here he's just going through the process. They go present themselves to the temple. If I understand this right and recall this right, there's a an inspection and stuff that the priests would do to, you know, to verify that they are now pure. And what they would do this a lot of times, people traveling in for a feast, which is what Paul is at least has wanted to do, is people would show up a week or so early and go through this process just so, you know, they would be counted as clean and pure to be able to partake in whatever the feast was, whether it was, you know, Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles or the Day of Atonement or whatever. These guys would go through this, and it was a week long, and there was a process to it, and you can look up and do a little research, because it's really not relevant to the story, but that's what they would go through. Verse 27, and when the 7 days were almost ended, so that week of purification is just almost over, we're 5 or 6 days or so into it, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. So some of his old friends, his old pals that up there in Asia Minor, in places like, you know, Ephesus, and they're back in causing trouble again. I can just imagine Paul rolling his eyes thinking, boy, I thought I left them, you know, hundreds of miles away, and they followed me here. But they're just there to celebrate this feast also, and they look over and, wait a minute, there's that rebel rouser. There's that troublemaker. Let's get him. We didn't get him back there, but hey, he's outnumbered here. He's really on Jewish turf now. Let's get him. So what are they going to do? They're going to make the exact same type of charge that they've been making all along. Verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place," that's speaking of the temple, "and further brought Greeks also into the temple and hath polluted this holy place." And that last statement's explained, verse 29. "For they had been before with him in the city, seen before with him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." So, here's the accusation. They grab hold of Paul and say, "Hey, look, this is the troublemaker. He's telling everybody you shouldn't be a Jew, and the temple doesn't matter." And you know, basically, you know, they're accusing him of undermining everything about everything that's sacred and ideal for a Jew. I mean, this would be like an American citizen suddenly embracing fascist communism and burning the flag and, spitting on Abraham Lincoln's grave. I mean, that's just what they're accusing Paul of doing, is just being a traitor to the Jewish religion, to Jewish customs. So verse 30, and all the city was moved. So, boy, they get the crowd and the riot going again. And the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. So there's a riot that begins to take place. They grab Paul. The crowd's just kind of out of control. They draw him out of the temple, probably because they're going to take him out and stone him. That's probably what is going on here. You can't do that in the temple. So they grab him, they get him out of the temple, they shut the temple doors, which is highly, highly peculiar. Why would they never shut those things during the day? So evidently this riot is out of control, and you know, they're glad to get them out of there. And until things calm down, they actually shut the doors of the temple. That's something that's only supposed to happen at night and in extreme cases. This evidently was an extreme case. Verse 31, and as they went about to kill him, which is, I'm sure they're carrying out to stone him, Tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Okay. Look at a map of ancient Jerusalem and you'll understand this a little bit better. Directly next to the temple was what's called the Fortress Antonia. It's named after Mark Antony. Herod helped to build this gigantic palace, and there's always this, I mean, let's say it's right next door to the temple, and there's always this little struggle going on between the temple and that fortress. They built a tower in the fortress, you know, that they could overlook and observe and kind of monitor what's going on in the temple. Well, the guys at the temple built a bigger wall so they couldn't see, and I mean, it's kind of funny, this little play. It's so odd. Right next to the holiest of holy places to a Jew is a garrison of pagan soldiers. The contrast just cannot get more extreme between these two places. And as I say, they're next door neighbors in ancient Jerusalem. But there is a garrison in there, and it's pretty much the only Roman garrison inside the temple. And the soldiers there, I think I've talked about this a little before. There's probably some Roman officers, but most of the troops are probably, at least rank and file troops, are probably Syrian, or, you know, maybe even some type of a Palestinian race. But they're not Jews, and their odds are probably not even Roman. But the captain there is the head of the band, so he's the leader, the ranking officer of the brigade, or of this troop that it's commanding the Fortress Antonia. So verse 32, he immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them, and they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. So here they come, and I can imagine, even if you look at modern riots, you see the guys with the big, clear shields and kind of working your way. They've got the formation, I think they call it a tortoise formation. Basically, there's a wall of shields, and they'll, move through a crowd. I can just imagine that's kind of what's going on here. These Romans with their big shields are pushing their way through the crowd, and they finally get to Paul. Everybody sees the Romans come, trouble, and they all scatter. And they make it to Paul and kind of rescue him from them. But as I said, the soldiers, not knowing what was going on, wondering what this guy is, they think, honestly, they're going aside at least temporarily with the Jews. They're like, boy, if he's about to be killed, he must have done something bad. So verse 33, then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains, and he demanded who he was and what he had done. So they bind him, thinking, boy, this must be a bad guy if it caused this riot. And basically, what is this? Is this for the safety and rescue of Paul? No, this whole thing is about keeping the peace in Jerusalem. That's what this whole episode is about. He's just trying to keep the peace. They're going to get this guy and just make sure if he needs to be killed, it's through proper channels. Verse 34, and some cried they get him, they tie him up and said, demanded who he was, what he'd done. He's asking the crowd, look, who is this guy? What did you do? Verse 34, and some cried one thing and some another among the multitude. And when he could not know and certainty for the certainty, could not know the certainty for the tumult. I cannot read this morning. He commanded him to be carried into the castle. That's the fortress. So can't figure out what's going on, who this guy is. And this is proper with a riot. I listened to a podcast, the How Stuff Works has a podcast called, Stuff You Should Know. And they actually did one on riots and the riot mentality. People just get swept up. They don't know what's going on, but they're just in this herd type mentality with everybody else. So he can't get a straight answer. He doesn't know what's going on. So just gets him back into the fortress where it's safe, and so he can straighten stuff out. So verse 35, and when he had come upon the stairs, which I'm not exactly sure what that is. That's evidently a place where it rises above the wall or something, where they could see the people, and they're probably carrying him up to be locked up in a tower or something. But he's inside the fortress and they're going up, and perhaps there's a balcony there because Paul's going to speak to the people. But anyway, they're going up some stairs, and it's very specific. So this evidently is a very specific architectural feature of the fortress that when Luke is writing this, someone who is familiar would know, oh, he's talking about that. So it's very specific. And he came upon the stairs, so it was that he was born of the soldiers for the violence of the people. Verse 36, and the multitude of the people followed after him, crying, away with him. That's not just, hey, take him away. It's kill him, off with his head. That's basically what they're saying. Verse 37, and as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, may I speak with thee? Who said, canst thou speak Greek? So there, I like this. There's a little bit of a interchange here with with Paul and this pagan, Roman captain here, and basically they're under trying to get an understanding of each other as they go into the fortress, and Paul's like, hey, can I talk to you? Can I at least get my word in? And the guy seems shocked, thinking, whoa, hey, you can speak Greek? So Paul addressed him Greek, which is, of course, the universal language, which would go back to this guy's probably not Roman. He probably is, like, as I said, like a Syrian or something like that. But he would speak Greek because it is the universal trade and commercial language. So he's kind of surprised. Like, can't thou speak Greek? Wow. Hey, you must be a smart Jew. I thought all these Jews were dummies. And you can speak Greek. And the captain continues, verse 38. Art not thou that Egyptian, which before these days madest an uproar and leddest out in the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers? So he's like, hey, aren't you that rebel, that troublemaker? He doesn't know who he is. He's just imagining, well, this guy must be one of the worst guys around. And evidently that was the worst guy he could possibly be. I mean, that must have been the Osama bin Laden of the time, as far as these Roman troops were concerned. And it sounds like it. And, this Egyptian Jew who was, trying to create a revolt and has 4,000 murderers is what they're called there. These rebels, but evidently less than scrupulous in their dealings. So verse 39, and Paul said, I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. That's not an average city. I'm of a fairly important city. And I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people. Verse 40. And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand, in classic Roman style, you see that hand upraised, palm towards the people. Listen to me. It's very Roman thing. I don't know why I always picture Roman doing that. And beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when they were... when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue. Now, the Hebrew tongue may not even mean he was speaking Hebrew. A lot of commentaries and stuff will tell you that he's probably speaking the Aramaic language, which really kind of was the dominant local language. It's very similar to, classic Hebrew, but it's not. It's actually like a localized language that the Jews adopted, and it's got similar roots and similar style and syntax and stuff to true Hebrew, but it's not. But he's addressing them in a language they would understand, which evidently was Aramaic. But I can't say that with all certainty. That's relying a lot on tradition. And what we're saying, he's not saying he's speaking Hebrew. He's speaking the tongue of the Hebrews, the language of the Hebrews, which, very likely could mean Aramaic. So we'll jump now into chapter 22, and this is going to be another long one. We're already 24 minutes in. But a lot of ground to cover, and I didn't feel right splitting this up because we have the lead up to this speech, and then we're going to cover the speech and some of the fallout here and get through chapter 22. So 22 verse 1, Paul begins to speak, men, brethren, and fathers. Hear ye my defense, which I make now unto you. So everybody listen up. Verse 2, and when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept their more silence, and he saith. So basically, when they heard him actually speaking their language, like, oh, wait, he's talking to us. So they stopped to listen. Verse 3, I am verily a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, who was one of the leading Jewish rabbis, one of the most influential of the time, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God, as ye all are this day. So it's like, look, I'm a Jew. I know what you're talking about. I've been a Jew. I'm a Jew by birth. I'm a Jew by custom. I'm a Jew by teaching, and just like you guys. Verse 4, and I persecuted this way. Once again, I've talked about it before. This way, he's talking about Christians. That's a nickname for the Christians in early, probably the earliest, was just calling them the way. Persecuted this way unto death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. Verse 5, and all, as also the high priest doth bear me witness, and all the estate of the elders, from whom also I received letters unto the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring them which were there bound unto Jerusalem for to be punished. So he said, look, I was out persecuting this church that I am now. I was out persecuting them, and I was on my way to Damascus. So does this sound familiar? What's he slipping into? He's starting to tell his testimony. Verse 6. And it came to pass that as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus about noon, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me. Verse 7, I fell unto the ground and heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Verse 8, and I answered, who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. Verse 9, and they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me. Verse 10, and I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, arise and go into Damascus, and there it shall be told thee of all things which are appointed for thee to do. Now, of course, as I'm reading through this, we've covered all this before at length. If you want to go back to Acts chapter 9, if you want to go back, you can do this, because let's say Paul's just rehashing. He's telling his testimony, and this is not going to be the last time. Paul is just forevermore telling his testimony, honestly, just like we as Christians ought to. We shouldn't be ashamed of it. You know, my testimony is that I was a little boy too scared to go to children's church. I was about 4 years old. And so one Sunday morning, I'm sitting in the big church, you know, big church, the adult service, and the preacher preaches on hell, and it scared me to death. And that night, that afternoon, my parents knew something was wrong. I told them I was scared. I didn't want to go to hell. That night after church, Sunday night after church, the assistant pastor took me into the pastor's office. We sat on the little couch inside the door just to the right. And we sat there, and he took his Bible. And I don't recall. I don't guess I was reading at the time, or at least wasn't a very good reader. But actually, I started reading very early. But I don't recall. But I remember praying. I remember feeling how as if, you know, the burden of the world had been lifted off my 4-year-old shoulders. And I remember that, you know, and we shouldn't run from that. We shouldn't hide our testimony. We ought be willing to give it at a moment's notice. You know, honestly, it's more effective than going through the Romans road. Just tell what happened to you. It's far more personal, far more powerful than just quoting scripture at someone. All right, so where were we? Verse 11, and when I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of them that were with me, I came unto Damascus. By the way, one more thing. While we're talking about testimonies, I had someone tell me one time, you know, we get so wrapped up. We like the dramatic testimony. The guy who was a murderer, you know, a biker, you know, in a biker gang, just the most, you know, the most evil, wicked person, how they suddenly made this dramatic change. You know what? That is a great testimony, and I praise God for it. But you know what ought to be just as good? The story like me, who was a little church brat who got saved, who didn't have to go into all that sin, who didn't. It doesn't make me better. It doesn't make me more, less saved or more saved than a vile, wicked, reprobate sinner that found the Lord. But you know what? Listen, both those testimonies ought to be just as powerful. Don't judge someone and expect a dramatic testimony. I don't care what it is. If they just picked up a track off the ground, read it, and got saved. I don't care if they grew up in the nursery and like I was, got saved when they were 4 or 5 years old. You know, listen, all of that, every one of those is a good testimony. Don't get caught up in, you know, needing the dramatic testimony. You know, listen, everyone's just as saved. And honestly, we ought to look at the one about the even a little kid being saved is probably being greater and more motivating than someone who ran from the Lord only to be saved later. That's free. Okay, so where was I? Verse 12. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good report of all the Jews which dwelt there. He's a Christian, but he's also a good Jew. Catch that? Verse 13. Came unto me and stood, saying unto me, Brother Saul, receive thy sight. And the same hour looked up upon him. Verse 14. He said, The God of our fathers hath chosen thee, that thou shouldest know this, know his will, and see that just one. Oh, I guess capitalized, talking about Jesus. And shouldest hear the voice of his mouth. Verse 15. For thou shalt be his witness unto all men of what thou hast seen and heard. And I'll say Paul's doing that right now. He's giving a witness of what he's seen and heard and giving his testimony. Verse 16. And now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized. Wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. So a little side note here. It's another one of those confusing verses talking about washing away sins. You know, baptism. Oh, baptized and washing sins away. Listen, Paul is not saved at this point. I can imagine the turmoil that's been going on in his mind in the hours, and there's many hours since what happened on the Damascus Road. But he is yet to fully embrace and put his trust in Christ, and that's what he's being told to do here, is to do that, be baptized, embrace the Christian religion, and you know, that's what he's being told to. He's not being told to get baptized to be saved. Verse 17, it came to pass that when I was, okay, so that pretty much wraps up that part of the testimony. Verses 17 through 21 are very interesting. This is a little incident that happened that this is the first time Paul's spoken of. Verse 17, it came to pass that when I was come again to Jerusalem, even while I prayed in the temple, I was in a trance. Now, remember, he came back to Jerusalem for a short time, caused a bunch of trouble, and they had to get him out of town. And he ended up going back to fleeing back to Tarsus, in fact. But he's praying in the temple. All this should appeal to a Jew. He's in the temple. God's going to speak to him specially. And that's something, I mean, think back to the story of John the Baptist's father, Zacharias, and having the angel speak to him in the temple. And you know, Jews place special emphasis on that, and this should have really caught the eye of caught the ear of a Jew, thinking, "Wow, God really must have spoke to him." Verse came again. He was praying in the temple, was in a trance. Verse 18. Now that trance was he's having a vision. A vision is in like the Old Testament deal. It's not like, you know, in a hypnotic trance or something like that. He's having like a vision. Verse 18, and saw him, saying unto me, that saw Jesus again, make haste and get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, for they will not receive thy testimony concerning me. So I was like, hey, get out of there. You're not doing any good. Verse 19, and I said, Lord, they know that I am in prison and beaten every synagogue, them that believed on me, on thee. And verse 20, and when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by and consenting unto his death, and kept the raiment of them that slew him. So it's like, look, I get out of here. Look, they have to know. You know my testimony. I've sit here and persecuted the Christians. I was in on the murder of Stephen. Verse 21, and he said unto me, depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. So I said, don't worry about the Jews. Your ministry is to be to the Gentiles. And that little insight, that little story, this is the first we've heard of this little private incident in the life of Paul. But it's just another case where Paul knew who he was supposed to reach, and Christ kept affirming, the Holy Spirit kept affirming to him, you know, listen, I know you love the Jews, I know you want to be with the Jews, but you need to reach the Gentiles. And I say, Paul never neglected the Jews. He always tried to reach the Jews. But Paul stayed true to this call. He preached the gospel to whoever would hear, and most of the time it was the Gentiles that he was out trying to reach. So Paul gets that far in his speech in verse 22. We're going to deal with the aftermath. And they gave him audience unto his word, and then lifted up their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth. So I'm like, kill him, okay? For it is not fit that he should live. Verse 23, and as they cried out, they cast off their clothes and threw dust in the air, which is the Jewish slash Middle Eastern slash Oriental, you know, that area, that time period, way of them saying they are very, very ticked off. They are very, very mad. They're throwing their, you know, throwing their jacket off, and the throwing the dust in the air, I don't get it, but that just meant they were really mad, okay? Verse 24. The chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle, into the fortress Antonia, and bade them that he should be examined by scourging, that they might know wherefore they cried so against him. So he still doesn't get, like, why are they so ready to kill this guy? What's going on? So he, as they come in, he's like, hey, sergeant, come over here. I want you to take him. We're going to torture him. You know, we're going to get the truth out of him. They're going to do the first century version of waterboarding on him, which is scourging. They're going to tie him to a, you know, tie him to a pillar, get out the, the whip, like they did with Christ, you know, in beating Christ, the same type of deal. Then they're going to beat him until they beat the truth out of him. That's the plan anyway. Verse 26, when the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, verse 25. And as they bound him with thongs, so I think that they're actually tying him to this, the pillory there to beat him. Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and is uncondemned? As many times as Paul's been beaten and in prison, he has not usually, very rarely, has thrown down his trump card. And that is that he is a Roman citizen, and what they're about to do to him is illegal. A Roman citizen, having Roman citizenship entitles you to some extra benefits. And part of that is to not be beaten unless you have been charged and convicted by the court. And, so basically what they are about to do is, these guys are non-Roman scum. We can just beat them and mistreat them and stuff. But because he's a Roman citizen, he gets a little bit special benefits. But Paul is usually not embraced that, or not even played that card, so to speak. In this case, as they're about to beat him, Paul looks at him and says, buddy, you're going to get in trouble. You know you're not supposed to be beating a Roman citizen, who hasn't been tried and convicted. So verse 26, when the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman. So it's like, oh, wait, let me go tell my superior officer. So they runs up, gets the chief captain, comes and says, look, this guy's a Roman. We better be careful what we're doing. And that's saying part of that, you have to realize, like I said, these guys themselves are probably not Roman blood. So, When they hear this guy's a Roman citizen, they perk up and it's like they're Roman soldiers. They're going to be familiar with some of the laws and the procedures and stuff. So it's like, wait a minute, this guy's a Roman citizen. So they're going to come down and ask, what's the deal with this? This is strange. So verse 27, the chief captain came and said to him, tell me, art thou a Roman? I can just imagine, that very condescending. You better tell me right now the truth, buddy. He said, yea. Which is to say, yes, okay, in case you're unfamiliar with that. Verse 28, and the chief captain answered, with a great sum obtained I this freedom. And Paul said, but I was free born. I almost wish that was reverse and born. I was born free, but anyway, tie into the movie and the song and stuff. But anyway, every time I read that, I want to say born free and breaking the song, but... So what's going on here? Let me dissect these two verses. It goes up, says, are you really Roman citizen? Paul says, yes, I am. The response the chief captain gives, talking about, great sum obtained out of this freedom. He was what the Romans call a novus homo, a new man. That gave him a lot of rights, but he was still looked down on because he was a first generation Roman who had just obtained this. He wasn't, had been a Roman for centuries or, for decades. He was a new man. And this was, slaves would become citizens and obtain their freedom and stuff, and they'd be called a novus homo. And they were looked down on and distrusted by the Roman citizens. And what this guy did to obtain his freedom, this right, this privilege, is He talks about with a great sum. Basically, this guy saved up his money and bought it. And not just, you know, went to an official and said, hey, I've got the fee to become a Rome assistant. This guy bribed an officer at some point to make him a Roman citizen, to confer this right, this privilege, this status upon him. And that's what's going on here. He's saying, wow, hey, I'm a Roman citizen too, but this is how I got it, is I had to bribe somebody to get it. And he's looking at this poor, beat up little crippled Jew and thinking, how in the world did you become a Roman citizen? You know, you're a Jewish scumbag. And, you know, how in the world did you become a Roman citizen? And Paul says, I was freeborn, says, I've been a Roman citizen from birth, which put him a step up. He basically just trumped this captain status by saying he was freeborn. So verse 29, then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him. And which means they got out of there. The people with the whip who were about ready to beat him and have some fun beating up on Jew said, uh-oh, we don't want no part of this. And they left the room. They left Dodge. And the chief captain also was afraid after he knew that he was a Roman because he had bound him. It's like, oh, wait a minute. I tied him up. I put chains on him. You're not supposed to do that to a Roman. I'm in trouble now. You can just imagine. I mean, he is scared. He knows he has made a mistake. And if the right people find out about this, he is in trouble for mistreating a Roman. Listen, Rome at times in their history started wars, or at least used as a pretense to go into war. The fact that some Roman citizens somewhere were mistreated or sold into slavery or killed, you didn't mess with a Roman citizen. Even at this point, when Roman citizenship is beginning to be, really conferred, it isn't universal. It's going to be sometime before, you know, all the people in the Roman Empire are Roman citizens. That's still, I think, centuries away. But you still, even though this guy's a Jew, even though this guy has never even set foot in Rome itself, has never even been on the Italian peninsula, because he is a Roman citizen, because he has those rights and those privileges, you don't mess with this guy, or you're going to suffer the consequences. And this guy, who's also a Roman citizen, has that same status, realizes, I just made a boo-boo. And all the other guys around them realize it too. And they'll say, they're probably not even Roman citizens because they don't have quite the status or the prestige or even the wherewithal, the money and such to get it. I mean, everyone knows, oh my goodness, we just made a mistake. So, I mean, everybody's scared. Verse 30, on the morrow, because he would have known the certainty wherewith he was, wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priests and all the council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Okay, so this is really tying into what we'll get into into the next chapter, into the next lesson, which is going to be Paul before the Jewish leaders, before the Sanhedrin council, most likely. But basically, a lot of this is just this captain in charge of the Roman garrison there is wanting to get to the roots of what's going on. He knows he's got to treat this situation right now, and that if Paul really is really deserves to die, you know, according to Jewish law, it's got to go through the proper channels. So he's going to take him before the Jewish council, who actually could condemn this man to death and deal with it. But basically, you know, he's trying to make sure why this Roman citizen, what's going on, trying to get to the bottom of the truth. So he's going to take him before the Jewish Sanhedrin, before the Jewish council, the chief priests and such, to figure out what's going on and basically give this Roman citizen a trial that he deserves and legally should have. So there we go. We wrapped up verse 22, and I really thought this would go an hour, and we're not quite 45 minutes in. Well, I guess we did pretty good. Anyway, I appreciate you listening today. I'm sorry if the audio quality, I've been watching it. I don't think it's going to be quite as good as normal. I kind of tweaked the setting, and I was too far in really to change it. So if it sounds a little quiet or it sounds a little off, I apologize, and I'll try to get it straightened out next time. kind of a limited time because my wife is out with the baby buying groceries, and my two sons are with grandparents. So got a free moment to do some recording. So I'm trying to squeeze it in, and no time for perfection when you're on a tight schedule. So anyway, I appreciate you listening today. I hope this has been a help and a blessing to you. Shed some light, you know, maybe in the culture or something, history of all this. I appreciate you listening today. Hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. Check out BaptistBasics.org, the other podcasts available, the Baptist History Spotlight, the other resources. And we'll see you next time as we continue on into Acts 23 and continue Paul and the Jews. I appreciate you listening. Matthew Gage, thanks a lot.